necessarily those of Absolute Broadcasting, its staff, or advertisers. It's time for Israel is Real. Two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Rahel and Sonia focus on life in modern 21st century Israel, telling the stories of ordinary people living in, loving, and in support of an extraordinary land. Israel is Real is a community-supported program featuring interviews with local, national, and international celebrities, personal life stories, and call-ins. Learn a new Hebrew word every week. Israel is Real. Every Friday on 1590 WSMN. Nashua's News and Talk. And now, your hosts, Rahel and Sonia.
Boker Tov, good morning. I'm Rahel.
And Sonia.
And this is Israel, Israel, the free voice for Israel. Boker Tov, l'kol ha'mazini.
Tzoraim tovim b'Yisrael.
From WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. And if you're listening on the radio, that's 1590 AM, or on the internet, WSMNradio.com. So, here we are. It looks like spring may be coming. I don't know. We've got pouring rain outside the window here.
But if we are speaking about spring, we will speak about Mitzrayim.
Ah, yes. Mitzrayim. Good idea, Mitzrayim.
And the question is from where this word that's coming, and in the end we will see what is it. So we can speak about metzer, which means sorrow or depressed or suffering. And we speak also about meitzar, which is a boundary.
A boundary.
A boundary, mm-hmm. Yes. So what this can be, Mitzrayim, which have the same
sorrowful
root.
Boundaries?
So Mitzrayim actually means Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like in the name Mitzrayim, you have both sorrow and then under a certain boundary for the Jewish people.
And it seems that that may be, I hope that won't be the case, but we're going to find out today about what's happening. It's kind of an update in what's happening in the region. And I'd like to introduce our guest today already. And this is a pre-recorded interview, by the way. We spoke to Dr. Mordechai Kedar on Tuesday this week. He is an Israeli scholar of Arabic literature, an expert on Arab and Muslim culture and thought, and a lecturer at Bar-Ilan University, where he also received his PhD. He served for 25 years in the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, in the military intelligence, where he specialized in Islamic groups, the political discourse of Arab countries, the Arabic press and mass media, and the Syrian domestic arena. Dr. Kedar drew world attention with a June 2008 Al Jazeera interview, in which he challenged the moderator, pointing out that Jerusalem is never mentioned in the Quran. So we have had Dr. Mordechai Kedar here often, and he just recently toured the States, and we are honored to have Dr. Mordechai Kedar here again today to update us on current events in the Middle East.
Adonai, shomati shimecho yoreti.
Boker Tov, Dr. Kedar. We're so happy to have you again, as always, and you're back in Israel after a successful tour in America. And I hope it was met with great success, and you met many, many new people, and were able to tell them a little bit more about Israel.
Yes, a whole month of wandering in the United States of America and in Canada as well. Very large space. I covered like 13 domestic flight, like almost every other morning. And thank God, it was very nice, very good. Very nice turnout in most, if not all, the events. And I must say that what happened in the Middle East during this tour actually reflected on everything which was said, because in most cases I didn't speak about the topic which was formally chosen by the people, but I had to speak about the events in the Middle East and where they lead to.
Well, and that's why we're speaking with you today. We want to, obviously there's been major changes in the Middle East, and we want to obviously talk about how that reflects on our wonderful country, Israel. But maybe before we do that, Sonia, did you want to ask our first question?
Bogatov, Dr. Kedar. Nice to have you again. The question is, my question is, how do you think the development will take place in Egypt?
Well, what happened in Egypt is they talk about Thawra, which is an Arabic revolution.
Okay.
But what happened is much less than this. Why? Mubarak was the fourth president in a row of presidents which started governing Egypt in July 1952. Until today, like 58 years, they developed a whole layer of people, corrupt usually, who are the ministers and the managers of the departments in the ministries, and in, they are all in the media and in the industry and the banks and the security organizations and the army and the police, and although I would say some together to 1.5 million or maybe 2 million people who benefit from being part of the system, large salaries and things like this, while 83 million people are carrying them, are being governed by those, usually with much resentment towards the corruption of the government and the people. What happened is, recently, is that Mubarak and his sons, means the, those who might succeed him later, they were ousted. But the whole system remained.
Mm-hmm.
The ministers and the managers and the heads of departments and sub-departments and in the police, most cases in the army and all those. All those fat cats which were governing the state for Mubarak, most of them, if not all, stayed. So now, the thing is, after they woke up from this dream of having Mubarak or having him ousted, the Egyptian people discovered that in spite of all the hopes to have a new morning, the sun rises up in the east and the sunset is in the west, and the same corrupt people are in the government as they were for decades. And this is now the problem in Egypt. Many talk about this. Now, on the other side, they know that they cannot change the whole system within a day or two, even not a week or a month. Because if they do it this way, in such a radical way, they might very possibly come to the situation where Iraq is. Because in Iraq also, they got rid of a whole system in order to build a new system without Saddam. A system who was not part of the Saddam regime. And this is why in Iraq it takes so many years And we are now almost 8 years after the invasion of March 2003. And the system in Iraq is not yet stabilized, only because it's a whole new system from top to toe. So the Egyptians do not want to get this situation. They want it much faster. So they know that they have to leave in function most of those people who are in the government. So the outcome of the whole revolution is more or less the same thing. Instead of an old army man, they have a new one, and a younger one. The same problems, the same economic problems. So more or less, what they have today is what they had before. So where are all the hopes? So now we have to look to the future. What happens in Egypt? The new government run by the army tries to appease everyone, to appease the Muslim Brotherhood and to appease the intellectuals, to appease the Copts and to appease the Muslims. And the government today looks like a government which wants to have nice, let's say, image. They don't want to be viewed as dictators. Maybe they do not even want to be dictators so far. And this is why you can't see a clear policy. On one side, they keep the peace agreement with Israel, but on another side, they don't renew the gas after the pipe was burned like a month ago. On one side, they declare that they are not going to change radically the foreign policy, but on the other side, they let Iran send warships across the Suez Canal, which was never before. So you don't really see today a clear policy, but what you see today is that attempt to be nice to all. So elections, mm-hmm. which might take place in the future, if these elections will really reflect the street and what the trends in the streets are, there is a big chance that the Muslim Brotherhood will have a large part of the parliament, maybe even a majority. And if so, maybe they have an Islamic government. And here we are in the same scenario of Turkey, which also came back to Islam after a secular revolution was forced on it by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk since the 20s of the last century. So, and this might be the future of Egypt. More participation of the Muslim Brotherhood, more Islamic behavior. I wouldn't say that they will turn into jihad state because they need the West. They need the food from America, from your country. They need the investments from Europe. They need the ships go through the Suez Canal because they need the seas. And they want the tourists
to come
back in order to feed millions of families who live from tourism. So this, I might say, the future. They would like to return to be what Egypt was before. Yet, Israel might pay some price by the peace agreement, which we either canceled or frozen or reduced by level.
Can you be a little bit more specific? What's the meaning to frozen or to reduce a level about the...
They might close the embassy, mm-hmm. and leave interest bureau in another embassy.
Okay.
Like Swiss or something like this.
Okay.
You know, only to represent Egypt to a very low profile.
Okay.
And they can, on the other side, demand that Israel also takes out the Israeli embassy from Cairo, and maybe Israel will have a representation in another embassy. This is what happens in these cases of reduction of the level of representation.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can maybe enlighten us a little bit about who the main players are in the region today and how that might affect things, how it's affecting things now, and maybe, I know we can't predict the future and it's very unstable, but who are the main leaders right now, the main players?
Well, definitely those rulers who were the faces of the Arab world for the last decades, definitely they are under threat. The thrones are shaking, and the street becomes more influential. Usually, thanks to the internet, which enables the street to organize itself in the absence of the normal media, which would give those people a mouth if they were in the West. But since they are in the Arab world, the state media does not let those people talk in the media or use the media for their purposes. So here we see the social websites like Facebook and Twitter, and maybe others as well, like YouTube, being the means by which people organize in order to go to demonstrations and to plan their further steps. Usually, the governments did not take these websites seriously. This is why those people succeeded to use these websites to their purposes, in spite of the fact that the government also knows the language. But apparently the governments neglected or ignored or didn't notice the fact that people use those websites in order to organize what we see today. So definitely they were using it, but it's wrong to think that something like what people call the Facebook revolution. Mm-hmm. It is not a Facebook revolution. This is the street revolution, which partially they use Facebook and other websites as a means how to organize their steps. Definitely the future will be more to the street rather than the governors. The future might also give power to the Muslim Brotherhood or to the Muslim Brotherhood organizations like Ennahda in Tunisia and other religious organizations in Morocco, in Algeria, maybe in Jordan as well. And the future is very problematic when you talk about Saudi Arabia, which might witness also a wave of demonstrations and unrest as of coming Friday, the 11th of March. And next Tuesday, week from today, what might start in Syria as well. Because these days were mentioned by the oppositions in both these countries, in Saudi Arabia and in Syria, to start the demonstration, start the revolution in their place also. We already see in Damascus, the capital of Syria, we see graffiti on walls about Bashar Assad, who is a butcher, a son of a butcher, of course, his father, Hafez al-Assad. There are other slogans like Irhal means go away, enough with a bath, a party. And all these, or the Syrian, I would say, version of those slogans, which we saw already at large in Egypt and in other places. So the revolution is still on the make. It didn't come yet to its last chord. And some more states in the Arab world are standing on the line to witness this unrest. The question is, what will be the attitude of the governments in both Saudi Arabia and Syria? I personally think that the army will shoot as it does in Libya, and not as it did not, as it did not shoot in Egypt and in Tunisia. In both Saudi Arabia and Syria, they more tend to be like the regime in Libya rather than the regime in Tunisia. And people might get killed in all these countries as well. So now the question is, what will be if Saudi Arabia shoots its citizens, especially the Shiite citizens, if they start demonstrating by using American weapons, which the Saudis have? Where will be the human rights NGOs? Where will be the government? Will Europe and the world enforce some kind of non-flight zones in Saudi Arabia only because they killed their own people? Or maybe the behavior of the world vis-a-vis Libya will turn to be something totally different from the behavior of the world vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia in the same situation. Is this some kind of hypocrisy? Maybe, maybe not. What will the world do in Syria when Syria starts shooting into demonstrations? Will the world treat Syria in a different fashion than Saudi Arabia or Libya? So here actually what I think is the interest today of Europe and America and other Western countries in the world are in the bottom line much more important than life of hundreds or even thousands of people who might be killed, as long as it doesn't affect the flow of oil from these countries to Europe and America. Nobody will really do something against this bloodshed, which might, at least in the Saudi case, might be carried out by using American weaponry.
This is WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk, and this is Israel is Real, the real voice for Israel. And I'd like to remind you that we are enjoying your donations. Well, we aren't personally enjoying your donations, but we are very glad to have your donations because they keep us on the air. One show is very cheap, and if you just contribute a little bit, it goes a long way. So please, also another thing you could consider is advertising on our show. Very, very cheap. $36 for 30-second ad. We'll read it just the way we're reading it today. So please, write your check to Absolute Broadcasting and send it to our personal email, our personal post office box at 236 Milford, New Hampshire, 03055. That's again, write your checks to Absolute Broadcasting. Send it to our personal post office box at P.O. Box 236, Milford, New Hampshire, 03055. You can also find more about that on our website at www.israelisrealnh.com. Israelisrealnh.com, and email us. We also want to hear your feedback at israelisrael1590@gmail.com. israelisrael1590@gmail.com. And I want to let you know about Vern Main. the patent and trademark law firm of Vern Main & Associates, a local firm with a global practice, is pleased to announce its new office location at 547 Amherst Street in Nashua and on the web at www.vernmain.com for professional legal counseling on all intellectual property matters. Contact the legal specialist at Vern Main & Associates at their offices on 547 Amherst Street, that's 547 Amherst Street in Nashua, New Hampshire, or on the web at www.vernmain.com, V-E-R-N-M-A-I-N-E, vernmain.com.
Did you know that the Vision is an organization that educates our community about the little country of Israel? Did you know that Israel is approximately about the size of New Jersey? And did you know that after the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel offered to the Arab state to exchange the land for peace? And the Arab states just refused. In order to receive Vision's email alert and to be informed about Vision's educational activities and opportunities, please visit Vision's website at www.newhampshireforisrael.org. That's www.nh4israel.org. And Rachel is spreading beautiful music across the globe to hear Israel... to hear Rachel's unique sound and to book Rachel to perform for you live, please go to www.rachelmusic.net, which is www.rahelmusic.net.
And we're going to return to our pre-recorded interview with Dr. Mordechai Kedar, an Israeli scholar of Arabic literature and an expert on Arabic and Muslim culture and thought, and a lecturer at Bar Ilan University. And he is updating us on today's current events. WSMN 1590, Israel is Real. Speaking with Dr. Mordechai Kedar, who is speaking to us from Israel. He's an expert on Arab affairs and Islam society. Dr. Kedar, it's very confusing to really understand so many sides of this. We've got people in revolution who have come up against authoritarian regimes, but they haven't really sort of thought it through. What they want in its place and how to go about getting what they want. They seem not to really know, or they seem to know but not to know how to get there. We have some regimes saying, giving up and saying, okay, give into that. We have some regimes fighting back, and it's such a big confusion. And in all of this, I have so many questions, I'm not really sure what to ask, but I'm wondering, are we forgetting Iran? And where is Iran? And we know that Iran maybe is perhaps the one orchestrating this, motivating this, inspiring this. I don't even know how to ask. And what do we think about Iran in all this? And I will lead you to another question as well, which is a separate question altogether. The whole Palestinian-Israeli thing going on, which people are trying to keep in the light and in the picture, is it relevant? Is it not relevant? Where are we going?
Well, none of these questions is easy to answer, but I'll try. About Iran, Iran also witnesses demonstrations for almost 2 months. Every other day, there are demonstrations, and the level of unrest actually is on the rise since the last 2 months. No doubt the Iranian regime will collapse sometime, but nobody can predict when exactly it will be and what exactly will push it to all topple it altogether. But there is no even one dictatorial regime in the world which survived more than some decades, because the life expectancy of illegitimate regimes is usually rather short. So definitely, Iran will see more and more unrest. But the question which nobody can answer is when this regime will come to its end. The second question about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. What became more and more clear in the last 2 months in the Middle East is the Palestinian-Israeli issue is non-issue. It means all these revolutions happened not because Israel was involved in those arenas, neither in Tunisia nor in Egypt. Not even one of these new faces in the Arab world cares about Palestinians, cares about Israel. And, of course, nobody will run to hug and kiss Israel. But
although we got a compliment from Gaddafi, I understand, that he said he was going to fight back just like the Israelis.
Yes, but also this, yes. In the cast-led operation, no one of the new leaders or new politicians in the Arab world uses Israel so far, uses Israel as a fig leaf to cover his own corruption. We still didn't get to this point, but it might come, because the new regime, if there is a new regime in Syria, or the Shiites in Lebanon, might use Israel in some kind of an enemy, which is supposed to threaten everybody and to unite under the aegis of the one leader which will come from the street. So Israel was this threat in brackets until today, and it might serve as such even in the future. However, I think that people are much more aware of the fallacy of such an allegation.
We are also wondering, the Palestinians are trying hard to establish statehood without speaking to Israel and involving Israel in this process, and instead involving the rest of the world through the UN. And the UN seems to be, I don't know if they complied or talking about raising their status and bringing them to some kind of, I'm not even sure what, nationhood or something, to make this movement more possible by bypassing Israel somehow. What can you tell us about this?
Well, today, when the Palestinians discovered that the Arab world actually ignores them, and the Palestinian issue became a non-issue in the Arab world, and days after days, all the Arab media is concentrated on Libya and in Egypt and in Tunisia and maybe further, and in Bahrain and in Yemen and in Iran, actually, the Palestinian issue became a non-issue. So the Palestinians are going around the world and collect states which will recognize the Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza, in spite of the fact that the negotiations with Israel so far have not yet started since the election of the Israeli government of Netanyahu. They try to reach the world and receive a worldwide recognition in September in the General Assembly of the United Nations, where no state has the veto. They would like then to establish the state by the recognition of the whole world, bypassing the need to sit with Israel and to give concessions. The future about this point or this development is not good from the Israeli point of view, because when the world recognizes the Palestinian state on the borders of 1948 until 67 on the West Bank, this will pose a threat on the being of Israel, because this will give the Palestinians a territorial contiguity between the Beersheba area in the south and Afula area in the north, passing through Tel Aviv, Netanya, Herzliya, and even Haifa, and they will be able to shoot missiles on practically 90% of the Israeli population, as they do today, only from Gaza. The world doesn't understand it. The world thinks that if Abu Mazen becomes the president of the Palestinian state, he will stay this president forever. They don't understand that there is no guarantee in the world that this Palestinian state will not turn eventually into a Hamas state or Hezbollah-like state. And everyone is carried away by the Palestinian demand to recognize them as a state, without giving any assurance to anybody that this state will forever remain a normal state and not become a jihadi Islamic Hamas state.
So if we will sum it up somehow, it's a continued pressure from U.S. and U.N. on Israel to make concessions?
Unfortunately, this is what happens today. Not because Israel should give concessions, but only because Israel is the only state in the Middle East which listens to America and to the other states in the West. Every other Arab state doesn't listen. They couldn't care less about what is said about them in Europe or in the United States of America or Canada and other places. So people and NGOs and politicians in the West decided to go on Israel only because Israel is democracy, which listens to what it said and actually might change something. So we pay the price of being a democratic state by concessions on our security and even being.
Yes, I've come to realize that the world expects us to make changes
suicide.
and to do whatever, because they know we listen and we take it seriously and we appreciate and respect their concerns as well. But it's just such a
hypocrisy.
It's just unbelievable to see that Israel is constantly made to compromise when, and we know that it's because the other side will never make compromise.
No, the other side have the oil.
And they have the oil. Well, okay. I'm wondering, what is the situation from the Israeli side inside Israel, living in Israel? We know that people live regular, normal lives, and this is always in the background, and it's always stretching Israel's population to the extreme, where when I'm in Israel, I see people are very tired and very, you know, dreaming of this utopia that could be, this paradise that could be, but just doesn't happen. How is life in Israel right now with all of this going on?
Well, the situation is not as gloomy as you might get the impression when you go in the street and talk to people. And we have some proofs. In the last year, 2010, the Israeli economy grew up by more than 5%, which is unique in the West, where Europe goes around 1% and even not even any growth. Here in Israel, the economy flourishes. The Israeli shekel turned to be one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, currency in the world during the last year, in spite of the crisis which overwhelms the world. And the real estate prices of apartments and houses in Israel is every day is another peak, which means there is a much demand, both domestic demand and foreign demand, to buy real estate in Israel, whether it's real estate for living, like apartments and houses, or commercial real estate. So on one side there is the mood in the street, but on the other side, the achievements of last year, which actually testify that the state is on the right path. So between this and that, we live. Of course, Israel developed this dream of having peace since the beginning of the State of Israel in 1948. But unfortunately, this region, or the actors of this region, are not standing in line in order to sign peace agreements with Israel. They, I would say, live on the conflict. Some of them, especially Palestinians, abuse this conflict for showing themselves as the oppressed ones in order to grab a world support and your world donations and other goodies from the world. So definitely there is much of propaganda which Israel is sick of listening to anymore. And they want to...
Not just Israel. We're all sick of listening to it.
So this is why we are eager to have peace. Yet the definitions of peace by the Israelis are not the definitions of peace in the Arab world.
I would like to sort of look on the brighter side, keep looking a little bit on the brighter side. I know that, for example, the governor of Boston, Deval Patrick, has gone on a trade mission to Israel, and there might be some trade, you know, there's startup businesses and lots of good things going on in that realm. And I understand even there are Palestinians involved in this. There are lots of good things. What kind of good things can we, and positive things can we look at that are going on in Israel that the world can benefit from? And looking past and beyond the
Living
revolution.
In Israel, first of all, we have normal life. In the schools, in the academia, in the arts, you see the halls of concerts and operas are full from wall to wall. You can see a very vibrant economy. You can see a very vibrant a democracy and freedom of speech and mass media. And actually, in spite of the fact that we live in the crater of the Arab or the Islamic even volcano, life in Israel is normal. We have the traffic jams, and we have every, especially after rain, little rain comes, and all the traffic lights do not function anymore, just like every other year. Means that that Israel functions just as it does for 60 years, and we live our life. Most Israelis, even when they are abroad, they dream about coming back to Israel, not because life is so easy here, but here they have meaning to their life. They are a part of a dream being fulfilled, dream of Jewish generations of 2,000 years, which dreamt about coming back to Zion and to have their home again built, both the private home and the communal and the national home being built on the land of Israel. And they are eager to take part, active part, in this Jewish renaissance which came to be in their generation.
So definitely,
yes, definitely, we Israelis are living this new horizon of the Jewish people by taking part in enforcing this state, in pushing it forward, and in actually building this Jewish state again after it was destroyed 19 centuries ago. So definitely we Jews in Israel are part of it, and most of us wouldn't even think about moving to another place. And when it comes to the necessity to fight for this country, when it happens once in a few years, we do it willingly, and the recruitment percentage to the army exceeds the 100%, means even those soldiers in reserve who are exempt from the army because of their age or because of their health or because of their I don't know what, they come whenever needed, they come to the army back and they demand to be recruited again. Israelis who live abroad compete or try to take the first flight to Israel when there is some kind of war or operation in the horizon, because they wouldn't like this operation take place without their own participants in this. So definitely, we Israelis are part of this project of renewal of the Jewish life on Eretz Israel, on the land of Israel.
And
we do it willingly and zealously.
And I think, you know, to also building the entire world. Dr. Mordechai Kedar, we have come to the end of our time, and we love having you on our show. We were excited to have met you in person finally, and we look forward to having you as always.
It is my pleasure, yes, and honor.
And thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mordechai Kedar.
You're welcome, Sonia and Rachel.
And we are Rachel and
Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real, the free voice for Israel. Sonia, how about a little bit of portion of the week, Torah portion? A little bit of manna.
A little bit of holiness.
Yes.
And our portion this week, Vayikra, the Torah describes the various korbanot, the sacrifices, which are brought into the tabernacle and later into the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. The root of the word korban, sacrifice, is karov, which means close or near. The essence of the korbanot, the sacrifice, was that they been brought Jews closer to God. Our lesson this week is therefore the following. Whenever we make sacrifices for our own values, which have to do also with our beliefs and have to do with God, we grow closer to God and the holiness that is God. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. We are Rachel.
And Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real. Our theme song, Hinei Matov, is by myself, Rachel Music, and that's rachelmusic.net. We are on the air every Friday from 10 to 11 in the morning on radio, WSMN 1590 AM, and also on the internet at wsmnradio.com. We are also, you can visit our website for archived interviews at www.israelisraelnh.com, israelisraelnh.com. We'd like to thank our guest and good friend by now,
Dr. Mordechai Kedar,
for all of his insights and updating us this week about the situation in the region, in the Middle East. And that's about it, I think.
Shabbat
I think
shalom.
We're good. Shabbat shalom. We'd like to thank George, too, today, coming back home to us. So Shabbat shalom from Israel is real, WSMN 1590. Thank you.
And then